JTech Studios in Atlanta, Georgia. It's America's favorite game show podcast. Tell them what they've won. And now, here are your hosts, Tom Bastek and Mike Jacobs.
And hello, everyone, and welcome in to America's favorite game show podcast, Tell Them What They've Won. I'm Tom Bastek.
And I'm Mike Jacobs. Hello, Tom. How are you doing this wonderful autumn morn?
It is. I wish it would get a little cooler, man. It's still pretty warm here in Atlanta this week.
And yeah, that's true.
I'm waiting for that good, crisp fall weather. So we got like a week of it, and I need more of it in my life.
Yeah, the crisp, I think, is the right word there. I like a bit of a nip to the air, as it were. Yeah, big fan of fall, and I wish we'd get just a hint chillier.
Yeah, but I'm very excited to be back for another fun-filled week of game show stuff. I want to say thank you to everybody who listened in last week. We got some good feedback on Card Sharks.
Yes, indeed. Thank you all to everyone again. And yeah, we got more.
Yeah, Mike, tell everybody. I've got to look this up. We did get a cool email that I want to pull up here. And while I do it, tell everybody about Behind the Show.
We have done a special episode in between our last season and this, where we dive into the ins and outs of the Charles Ingram scandal, gentleman famously known for cheating at the British version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. How could that happen, you ask? Well, listen to the episode and find out.
So I want to throw this out there. We got an email this week from a gentleman by the name of Scott, and he just says, in a quick response to Christian's comment about Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy pairing on TV, at least in Iowa since the 1990s, Jeopardy is aired at 3 or 4 p.m., and Wheel of Fortune airs at 6:30 between the local news and the network prime time. I've always found it interesting hearing a community saying the shows are inseparable on a TV schedule when they've never been paired together for me.
Interesting.
How crazy is that?
Yeah.
I guess I've always seen them paired together, so I've never even thought that they may not be together everywhere.
Yeah, I didn't. Same here. I didn't think about that. I thought that was just some sort of national decision that was made. yeah, this is kind of like when I found out that Shane Company was not a local company. I really thought Shane Company was just in Atlanta, and sure enough, yeah. I mean, it turns out that's their advertising gimmick, is they want it to seem that way. So good on them for doing it right.
And they do a good job of it, because you've always got a friend in the jewelry business.
Exactly.
Shane Co. and ShaneCo.com.
Open Saturday and Sunday till 5.
If we don't get a sponsorship from them at this point, I'm done. Anyway, all right, so this week we're featuring the game show Let's Make a Deal, Mike.
Yeah, I had a surprising amount of fun with this one. I was expecting maybe a more Gong Show type reaction from myself, in that, you know, since it's all about the contestants being wacky, but the wackiness is really not a part of the game show. It's just a gimmick, kind of, and there's not a lot going on, to be honest with you, but I did have a surprising amount of fun watching it, and there's a lot of like nail biting. It's all just tension and luck, but it's fun. I had a great time watching it.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I'm the show guy. There's not a lot of gameplay here, but that's why I'm surprised you liked it as much as you did. I, even though I'm the show guy, I'm not a big fan of this. And when we get to we talk about the Wayne Brady version, the current version that's out there, which, gosh, has been going on for, what, 10 years now? 11 years?
I think more than that, maybe.
Yeah, because I was in Vegas when it first started filming, and we'll talk about that and how that may have been the reason why it sours me a little bit.
I see.
But we'll talk about that in a bit. Right now, though, what do you say we do some news?
Yes, indeed. Where's Christian at?
Light up your cigarette, crack open a beer, put the kiddos to bed. From chaos around the world to carnage in your very old front yard, it's time for the news.
Thank you very much, Tom and Mike. This is the news, brought to you by BuzzerBlog.com. I'm Christian Carrion. The brains behind one of ABC's biggest game show hits are back for the thrill of The Chase. ABC is rebooting The Chase, the popular quiz game that has enjoyed over a decade of success on the UK's ITV, as well as a four-season American adaptation on GSN, not to mention all the versions around the world. Immensely popular show. The ABC version is going to be hosted by Sarah Haynes, who's a cast member on The View, and she'll host as teams of contestants match their trivia skills against The Chaser, one of a rotating cast of intimidating quiz geniuses. The Chasers this time around: Ken Jennings, Brad Rutter, and James Holzhauer, three of the greatest Jeopardy players of all time, who most recently participated in ABC's Jeopardy Greatest of All Time event. Although casting info was released at the beginning of the year, COVID prevented the show from entering production. No premiere date has been set. I think it goes without saying that I'm unbelievably excited for this show. The Chase is an incredible game.
Are you going to go back on there and redeem yourself?
I wish I could. You know, I've mentioned this a couple of times, but I was in the running for a second chance episode back on GSN. They called it got to the point where they called me and asked when I was free, but I think the show got canceled before that could materialize. I don't know what it's going to be like now with COVID. I'm sure they're looking for contestants that are just like a walk away from the studio.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, we'll find out. I have to be good at this game sometime.
Where do they film that at, Christian?
It would most likely be in Los Angeles. I think Brad is local to Los Angeles now. James lives in Vegas if he doesn't have a home now closer to California. And Ken lives on the West Coast as well. So I think California makes the most sense.
Right. Cool. Well, I mean, Mike, what do you think? You like The Chase?
Yeah, I think it's an awesome game show. I think they're going to be excellent combatants or chasers or whatever. And
oh yeah, those three guys, that's amazing. Yeah. That's like the three brainiest guys in the world of the US. Anyway, I love it.
It's gonna be real stiff competition for anyone who gets on that show, for sure.
All right, Christian, what else you got for us?
Well, another classic game show is returning to the air. Chain Reaction, the classic word game that has aired in several incarnations throughout the 80s, 90s, 2000s, is returning to GSN for the third time. Now, Chain Reaction sees two teams of players compete to solve linking word puzzles by revealing one letter at a time. Originally premiered on NBC back in 1980 and hosted by the late, great Bill Cullen, the show bounced around cable in the U.S. and Canada for several years, having been hosted by Jeff Edwards, who was famous for Treasure Hunt and Jackpot, and then a Canadian TV personality named Blake Emmons, who did the Canadian version. The host of the newest GSN version is none other than Dylan Lane, who fronted GSN's first attempt at rebooting the series back in 2006. Now, he replaces Michael Catherwood, who for a year hosted an updated Chain Reaction, again on GSN, that was met with lukewarm reviews by fans and critics. I mean, it's a great game. I'm interested to see how the host plays out. I remember being very disappointed with Dylan Lane's hosting back in the day.
Yeah, I have very, very vague memories of the show. I don't think I could place any specific memory about it. So, I mean, I don't think I have really an opinion one way or the other, to be frank with you.
I've watched it a couple of times, just a couple of episodes online, and I like it. I dig the premise of it. And, you know, at first I was like, oh, this is impossible. And then you kind of start to move along. You're like, oh, okay, I see how they're going here. This isn't that bad.
In terms of play along, it's up there among like the top shows. Like, it's so easy to play along with, and it's really a lot of fun. I personally love word games, so it definitely strikes a different nerve with me than it would with somebody else. But I love Chain Reaction. I'm interested to see them finally, hopefully, do a good job with this game. I don't think that it's been a really good game show since the mid-80s. You know, I don't think that they've really done it justice after that point.
I do like word games, so I'll definitely be checking that out.
Cool. All right, this week in game show history.
Yes, sir. This week in game show history, we are going back to November 9th, 1933, the birth of one of my favorite hosts. He's fantastic. There's no other way to describe this man's talent. His name is Jim Perry. Now, I know we talked about Card Sharks last week, and he was a huge part of that success from 1978 to 1982 on NBC. That was his first stateside appearance as a game show host. Well, that was his first popular, you know, that really sort of put him on the map. In the 60s, he hosted a sort of bingo themed show on local TV that sort of made it in syndication, but he definitely wasn't a famous name by then. Jim Perry, born in New Jersey under the name Jim Dooley. He was really tall. A lot of people don't realize how tall Jim Perry was. He played basketball and later in his career became one of these rare personalities who hosted several shows in Canada and also commuted to the United States to host shows. So while he was hosting Card Sharks, he was traveling to Canada to host a game called Headline Hunters, which was a sort of trivia based on current events. And he was also the host of the Miss Canada pageant for several years. He was incredibly famous in Canada for that. Actually infamous for one moment where a protester hit him with a sack of flour while he was hosting, and he did the rest of the show. The rest of the show covered in flour, completely unshaken. He's just unbelievably smooth, and a lot of people don't realize his struggles with self-love and his self-esteem. He was very hard on himself throughout his career, and that's not something that's not chronicled in a lot of the, you know, stories of his life, or, you know, even on his Wikipedia page, you know, you don't see a lot of mention of it. But after he retired as a TV host, he did write two self-help books that sort of chronicled his struggle with accepting himself and accepting his talent. And I read one of them, and he was a very talented writer as well as a talented host. But yeah, Card Sharks, Sale of the Century, it just, the list goes on and on. He's unbelievably cool.
I remember him from both Card Sharks and Sale of the Century, and it, you know, he just is like, out of all the people, remember we've constantly talked about who Guy Smiley is modeled after. He really reminds me of Guy Smiley a little bit.
Well, he's it. He has the grin. He has the big shiny teeth. He has the voice. He's just smooth and charming. And yeah, he's just, that is. And it's funny because if you ask a lot of people who watch game shows who their favorite hosts are, he very rarely makes the list, but he is unbelievably talented. And you look back on his work now, and it's just unbelievable how good he was.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
All right, this week, Christian, we're doing Let's Make a Deal. Your thoughts, your info, what do you got for us?
So I like Let's Make a Deal. I am a much bigger fan of the original Monty Hall version than I am of the current version. I think the current version is okay, but there's a certain charm that comes with the 60s, 70s, 80s versions. And a big part of that is Monty Hall. I mean, talk about the perfect marriage of format and host. Monty Hall and his ad-lib skills and his ability to sell and to draw suspense and to draw out moments. And, you know, it's hard to believe how much planning went into an episode of Let's Make a Deal, and just how much technical acuity you have to be an effective host of that show. Monty Hall was just a genius in that way. And the show was really well prepared. You know, before the show premiered in 1963, it was created by Monty Hall and his business partner, Stefan Hatos. And what they did was they took this format, you know, the idea of here's a prize, here's a door. Do you want to give me your prize for what's behind the door? And taking that concept and stretching it out into a show, they went to Weight Watchers groups. They went to Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. They went to any public meeting they could and said, hey, can we try this game with you? So by the time it hit the air, it had been refined so greatly that there was no choice but for the show to be a hit. It was a hit on NBC at first. They were the number one network on TV, largely due to Let's Make a Deal. They then moved to ABC in the 60s, and soon after, ABC became the number one network. So talk about a valuable show. And talk about a popular show. You know, the wait time at various points for tickets for the show was like in excess of 2 years.
Wow.
Like that's how long it took to get tickets to Let's Make a Deal. There's a documentary called Deal that came out in the 70s that sort of chronicles the backstage happenings of the show. Really, really interesting. Lots of cool behind-the-scenes footage and just how smooth a show like that has to work. Borrowed a lot, of course, from... Well, The Price is Right, of course, borrowed a lot from Let's Make a Deal, down to the three doors on stage, which is something you might not think about immediately, but they definitely have that in common. So much so that the pilot for the current version of Let's Make a Deal, hosted by Wayne Brady, was taped on the set of The Price is Right, and they repainted the doors to look like Let's Make a Deal.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
There's a did you know. Holy cow. Wow.
Here you go.
This is why this guy is never going to be the chump. You know that, Mike, right?
Well, we'll see. We got a Let's Make a Deal question for him this week.
All right. It is time for Stump the Chump. We're going to see if we can stump our resident historian and news guy, Mr. Christian Carrion. By the way, if you'd like to submit a question, please do so through our social media and or you can send a message through the website. We'd be very happy to ask your questions of Christian and make them tough because he comes up with this amazing stuff that we don't even possibly have the slightest clue of knowing.
I have a reputation for knowing things, but I got to tell you, I am never less nervous when this segment comes up. And that is genuine. That's not even on my script. I am so nervous to hear this question. I'm nervous to hear it every week.
Wait. Okay, you said the word script. If there's one thing I can promise we don't have, it's a script.
That is very true.
Wait, hold on a second. Yes, that's right, Tom.
There are no scripts.
All right, so let's have the question for Christian right now. Go ahead, Michael.
All right, from the debut of the show until 1977, I want the name of the longest tenured model on Let's Make a Deal.
Well, there were several, and I'm sure that in the beginning of the run there were quite a few. Not a lot of the tapes of the first few years of the show are known to exist. They destroyed a lot of tape back then to recover the profits. Nobody thought there was a rerun market for game shows. Fast forward to the 90s, and that's 80% of rerun TV. but I know that there were a few models, but the longest tenured model on Let's Make a Deal is a person who became pretty famous, actually, due to her role on the show. And her name was Carol Merrill, and she was, as the show went on, became the quintessential model. I mean, she was it. She was the one. You know, the way of, you know, Vanna White became synonymous with Wheel of Fortune, Carol Merrill was synonymous with Let's Make a Deal. Very barely had a speaking role. I can probably count on one hand the number of times she spoke on the show, but she just had such an enigmatic quality to her, and she just had this way of looking straight at the camera, and she just had a demeanor about her that was different from a lot of other models, especially, you know, when you get into the 70s and you talk about things like The Price is Right that really popularized the idea of female models for prizes and things. But yeah, Carol Merrill was the longest tenured model on Let's Make a Deal, and she was famous well into the 80s and 90s. I think I saw her on like a reunion special, one of these like talk shows in the 90s did like a game show reunion thing. So they reunited Monty Hall and Carol Merrill, who lived in Hawaii at that time. And her last on-camera credit was for Game Show Week on Hollywood Squares. They had Rod Roddy announcing and Carol Merrill modeling the prizes, which is like unbelievable. Not to mention Peter Marshall came back to host for an episode, but that's a long way to say Carol Merrill.
Clearly, I need to ramp up this a little bit.
Dude, you don't have a chance in hell against this
right?
man.
I mean,
oh my God.
I figured maybe since like it was a long-running thing, it was a known fact, but I didn't think, I mean, it's obviously not Vanna White level of knowledge,
notoriety, right? Amongst the, yeah, I mean, I have no, I couldn't name any model
other than the one that's on there right now, Tiffany, what, Kanye or Koye or Kanu, yeah, I don't even know how that's, yeah. Anyways.
I'm just shocked, like, wow, yeah. Okay. So we're the chumps again. This is the second week in a row. We are the chumps. I will take
Well, technically
that,
not the second week in a row because we did.
Well,
miss last
you're right because we missed
yes.
it last week. But
yes,
please go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say Christian is undefeated.
Yes, he is.
For two non-consecutive episodes. We are some Grover Cleveland motherfuckers.
All right. So if you've got a question for us, please send it in. And otherwise, how about a plug for BuzzerBlog?
Of course, BuzzerBlog.com, the number one game show website in the world. Whether you're looking for casting information, information about new shows, returning shows, classic hosts, BuzzerBlog.com is the place to go. Join everyone who loves game shows, whether you're a casual fan, whether you're an industry insider, or total nerds like me, Tom, and Mike, BuzzerBlog.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Christian. We appreciate it. We'll see you next week.
Yes, sir.
For those of you who don't know, we record the news with Christian earlier in the week. And unfortunately, some terrible news was passed yesterday. and we felt it was super necessary to bring him back and talk a little bit about the death of incredible game show host Alex Trebek. And so Mike and I and Christian are here, and we're going to chat a little bit about it. And Christian, first, your thoughts, obviously.
Well, you know, and I'm gonna do my best to get through this, because this kind of stuff is really important to me. Wow, you don't want to sound like this. All right.
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's all right. Take your time.
I mean, there's no other way to say it. He was one of the reasons why I want to do this for a living, why I wanted to work in broadcasting. I've grown up watching Alex Trebek for years, the host of Jeopardy, but the host of so many other things. One of the few game show hosts who were in the early 90s had three shows on at the same time. He was hosting Jeopardy and syndication, To Tell the Truth, with the panel of celebrities guessing who's right, real, whatever it is, on NBC, and also Classic Concentration. So talk about just making money in the early 90s. Just one of the few to do that, and to do it so well. One of the things about Alex Trebek is his performance ability. Peter Marshall from Hollywood Squares once said that Alex Trebek is the best host he's ever known, one of the reasons being that he does everything without cue cards. Everything is just off the top of his head. And, to be able to pull off such a consistent performance, especially, in a situation like that across so many different shows, it just speaks so much to his ability. Just one of the greatest. I mean, there's really no other way to frame yeah. that.
Obviously the man's super intelligent. I mean, God bless him. But I mean, he just had such poise, and he was so reassuring. And it was so funny because if Alex Trebek said it, then it had to be true.
Oh yeah.
Oh man, yes, absolutely. And that's the thing is, growing up and like realizing that like I think one of the great disillusionments of childhood is like, Alex Trebek doesn't actually know everything. But the thing is, like, I bet he would be pretty darn good at Jeopardy. And not just because he's been there hearing this stuff. Like you say, he's a smart, smart dude.
Well, in terms of television, especially in terms of game shows, he did something that is really, really rare. And the only other instance I could think of is the original host of Jeopardy. He transcended the role of game show host and became an authority figure, became a sort of symbol of trust. I mean, there have been surveys throughout his time on TV that put him at the top of trusted TV personalities, right up there with, people who read the news, and right up there with, what we would assume to be the most trusted people on TV is the host of Jeopardy. I mean, how many shows can do that to their host, and how many hosts could pull that off? It's a very short list.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, it is not just based on Jeopardy, right? Like, it's his personality, his poise, his rapport with people. Like, he's got that real, like, it's not even a father figure. It's like a cool uncle, not like a party cool uncle, but just like a chill uncle. I don't know. He reminded me a lot of my uncle, who's still with us. But yeah, it just, I don't know, a way of interacting with people that always just felt very natural and welcoming and like cozy. Like his voice was like a warm blanket.
Totally reassuring. Yeah. I mean, just amazing. Absolutely amazing. And what's crazy is that, the man worked through stage four prostate. Was it prostate cancer? No.
Pancreatic cancer.
Yeah. Stage four is literally you have stage four cancer. That is like the worst pain that you could possibly have. And he fought through it and finished up, the end of May with filming. And we've got episodes now coming all the way till Christmas. That's how strong that man was.
Right. Actually, his last, he's even stronger than that. His last day in the studio was last week, was October 29th. And so they have episodes in the can. His last episode as host is going to air on Christmas Day.
Christmas Day, yeah.
That's great.
What a gift that is to everybody, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just, not only a good host, and not only good at at running a game, but just a good broadcaster. I mean, when he started on Jeopardy in 1984, he had already been in broadcasting for 20 years at that point, and he had already hosted shows. I mean, you know, in America alone, he had High Rollers, he had Double Dare on CBS in the 70s, he had the $128,000 question, where he was already getting practice reading those types of questions. And even in Canada, I mean, he was already a super experienced broadcaster at that point. So, you know, you just talk about how those skills translate to hosting a show like that. It's just, I can't think of a more perfect match.
That's going to be extremely hard to succeed him. There will never be a replacement for him. There will be a successor, but never a replacement.
No,
yeah,
never.
You can't. Never. That's something you can't replace. One thing that is sort of a family tradition of mine when someone passes, and I would like to maybe carry on here, is, I mean, obviously we speak well of them and remember them fondly and all that, but we like to tell maybe funny stories or more lighthearted, like, you know, celebrate life kind of thing, as opposed to mourning their passing.
Sure.
And mine is, it's such a small little thing, but it's something that stuck with me forever, and I will never forget the sound of it. But I had Jeopardy on the N64, and, you know, up until that point, the idea of voices in video games were like very, very poorly digitized or, you know, non-existent even. But they had his voice not reading the questions, but, you know, doing the like interstitial and saying whether you're right or wrong or whatnot. And there were all these different audio clips for if you get it wrong, you're like, ooh, that's not right. And all these different ones. And there's one of them that happens every so often where he just says the word wrong. And the way he says it, it crushes you to your soul. It's just like, it's like he's so wrong he can't even think of what else. It's just wrong. And
it's like you're letting him down.
Right. It's a disappointed wrong. It's exactly what it is. Whenever I get anything wrong ever, that is immediately the voice that comes into my head is Alex Trebek just going wrong.
Well, I mean, yeah, at least you're living up to his expectation. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
All right. I got one.
Okay.
So I was fortunate enough once to hear Alex Trebek tell the story of the first time he tried pot brownies.
Really?
It was in the 70s in Hollywood, and if it was the mid 70s, he was on High Rollers, and he was at a house party, and the guy used to love chocolate. His lunch used to be a Diet Coke and a Snickers, and he went to the doctor, and the doctor said you have to stop that, so he switched to a Diet Pepsi and a Milky Way. The guy loved chocolate. So there was a plate of brownies on the counter in the kitchen. And he was like, well, hell, I love chocolate. He had like six or seven of them. Didn't realize they were pot brownies.
Boy.
They had to carry Alex Trebek out of the house like 4 days later. He was comatose.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man. High Rollers indeed, right?
You know?
My goodness, that's great. He was just the guy that I always like emulated when, like, I liked Pat Sajak just fine. But it was like, John Davidson and Alex Trebek were like my two like go-to guys. Like they were like John was more of the relaxed thing and Alex was more of the serious and proper thing, you know? And I felt like I needed to be able to master both of those if I was truly going to be a game show host or an MC or a broadcaster of any kind. Mm. And so they were the two that I constantly watch. And, you know, I was watching Jeopardy every single night with my parents anyway. So, I mean, it was easy to study him. But I will tell you, it just, no matter how good I thought I got asking questions, I never had the same poise as Mr. Alex Trebek.
No, definitely not. And, you know, you touched on an interesting topic there that I think is fairly ubiquitous in American culture is the like family watching Jeopardy together. You know, that it was like an event. We would almost plan our evenings around, like, we had to be done with our homework in time so that we could watch Jeopardy after dinner. And like, it's, yeah, I don't know where I'm going with this necessarily, but it's just such a, it has to be due in no small part to Alex Trebek's just wonderful, wonderful job. And I don't know. I can't imagine any sort of almost snobbish highbrow show like Jeopardy would be able to succeed with anyone other than him, being that he was able to, like you said, give it that air of seriousness and poise and properness, but also having a very relatable, real, approachable feel to him as a person, a very warm, kind personality, you know?
Yeah, it's going to be big shoes to fill there. Well, as I said in our tweet that went out yesterday, I, you know, he may be Canadian, but he is still an American treasure. He's an American treasure here in the States for sure.
Absolutely. He's a world treasure, if you ask me.
Yeah, absolutely. Alex Trebek, unfortunately, passing away at 80. Thanks, guys, for sharing your thoughts tonight, and we appreciate it. We'll be back right after this with the gameplay for Let's Make a Deal. You've been listening to America's Favorite Game Show podcast. Tell them what they've won. I guess you could say it technically was, I read the other day, the longest running game show of all time.
What?
Yeah, because the year that it came out, and it still runs today, not continuously, obviously.
Interesting. I like that.
So how about that?
Man, what a way to start it off. I thought this was going to be kind of a sleeper episode, but that really, that little tidbit really got me going.
Yeah, I read, you know, the funny thing is I read that and I was like, oh, that's wrong. That's so wrong.
Right?
And then I was like, wait a second. Okay, if you talk about the day that it debuted and the fact that it's still running now.
All right, well, now they need to bring back You Bet Your Life then, and then that can take back over as...
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, the theme song there, played by a live band. We've mentioned this before about how fun it is when game shows have live band accompaniment, and this one absolutely does. There was a live band in the original show. The new version is not a full band, but there is live musical accompaniment still going to this day. So thumbs up there. I always like that.
Yeah, and you even got that guy now with Rain Brady that's got like the keyboard that's like tipped forward.
Oh, so you can see it on screen?
Yeah, it the guy's name is Cat Gray, and apparently, I mean, he's played for a whole bunch of crazy bands and whatnot, but apparently he wasn't getting as much camera time back in the day when he was touring with bands and whatnot as the guitarists were. So when he had his solos, he would tip his keyboard forward so people could see him, and then he would get more time. How about that? Craziness, right?
Clever.
Anyway, but yeah, so we were talking about, we love the fun of a live band.
Yeah, absolutely. They got it going on here. The show itself, though, the gameplay is pretty simple. The host just kind of wanders around the audience and makes deals with the audience members. Now, so when we say the audience members, it's not literally the entire audience. When you watch the show, you'll see there's a much larger audience than the space that the host occupies. They do select a few chosen people to sit in this specific area. They call them traders, with a D, not a T. And those traders sit in this specific area, and that's where the host will be pulling contestants out. So if you get chosen to sit in that area, you know you at least have a chance of being a contestant. And so what this show is really known for, its sort of hallmark trait, is the contestants would wear silly costumes, outrageous outfits, crazy, whatever they could do to make themselves noticed. And that makes it more likely of them getting picked to be a trader in the trading area, or more likely to be a contestant overall.
Did you read about how that started?
No, I've kind of assumed it just started naturally. I know The Price is Right discourages that.
Yeah, so basically what happened was some lady wore a chicken costume once. Like in the beginning, there was like nobody dressed up. And Monty Hall thought it was so amazing that she actually wore a chicken costume. He had to call on her. And so he called on her and she became a contestant. And so like a couple of days later, somebody else wore a costume and he got called on. And then it just grew into what it is today.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's probably exactly why The Price is Right discourages that, because once you start doing it, you open the floodgates for everybody to do it. And then you just become, let's make a deal.
Right, right.
So let's talk about what the deal is. Basically, it's just a choice for the contestant to make. There's all sorts of different ways that they present this. But the idea is that you're given a modest prize, a small amount of money, a decent, you know, like a grill, something like that. And then you can make a deal where you can give away the prize that you've just won for a mystery prize, which could be something way better or could be just, you know, hot, stinky garbage. So the deal is often in the form of some sort of mini game, maybe a trivia, general knowledge sort of thing. A game of chance is often popular. A lot of times they will do pricing games along the lines of like what Price is Right does. This is obviously some product placement to maybe get a little extra cash. And if you get the sort of bummer fake prize, they call it a zonk. And it means you lost, basically. Now, you can actually win the zonk. So, for example, you might get a donkey or, you know, a pile of old straw. I don't know. That's not one I actually saw. But I'm just making up something that's just, like, goofy and not a real prize. Right. Legally speaking, you do win whatever that is. Now, at the end of the show, they give you the option to trade it in for real money. I believe currently you get $100 for trading in any zonk prizes. But you do get to keep them if you want, and you can take it home, which I would, honestly, unless it's the case where it's an animal that they legally can't give you, or I don't know if that's legal, I'm not certain one way or the other, but I know they don't give the animals to the people. I would just take whatever zonk they gave me, just because it would be hilarious to have that in my house, like a real zonk from Let's Make a Deal. I think that would be great.
Yeah, I think it's cool. I mean, I did see one episode where they gave away a lion cub or a tiger cub, and I'm like, okay, I'm doubting someone's going to be really taking a tiger cub home.
No, there is a thing I read that said that none of the animals were ever given away. There were two categories of zonks that could not actually be taken home, and one is live animals, and the other, which you know, I feel is vague on purpose to maybe give leeway, is if it's owned by the studio. So I think they could technically claim that any of the prizes were owned by the studio and not give them away and have to change it in for the $100. I would imagine over the course of the years, not too many zonks were kept, because I don't think a lot of contestants would keep a crummy prize over $100. But I absolutely would.
Yeah. And that's the kind of thing, like if you get this like terrible Christmas plate that is awful and you've got it up year round and people are like, why do you have this Christmas plate? And you go, oh, that was my zonk from Let's Make a Deal.
Right. And then three generations later, your great, great grandkids are telling their kids about it, whatever. I don't know. I think it's great.
Yeah.
So what they would also do sometimes is sort of the fake out, which is always good, which is where they make it look like a zonk, but then the zonk reveals an actual good prize. Like you get a hairbrush so that you can sit at your new gold-plated vanity seat or whatever, you know.
Wow. Okay.
A lot of times those would involve the product placement, which I wonder how that makes the product feel. Because like on one side, it's like, yeah, okay, here's... It's like a month's worth of instant rice from Uncle Ben's, right? It's like, okay, cool. Like, I guess Uncle Ben's get their name out there, but their name is associated with a prize that someone doesn't want. But then it reveals, you know,
a trip to San Francisco.
Right. Exactly. So anyways, I just thought I like when they do that. The fake out is always a little fun.
Yeah. I didn't realize they do that, but that's great. You know, I love that. That's fantastic. Go ahead.
Yeah. So per the original rules, and they still kind of do this a little bit, but the contestants were supposed to be actually making a deal in that it's not that just they're picked and they're given a prize. It's they're picked and Monty will give them their prize in exchange for something. So the original idea of this is that you're supposed to bring something in to put up for trade. Now, it could be literally anything, a tricycle, a, you know, fleck of lint, you know, and he'll Monty will come up and buy it from you. But that was largely, I guess, ceremonial, and they don't really enforce it. I think it's still technically part of the rules, but they do those quickie games, what they call them, quickie deals at, during the end credits, where Wayne Brady will go through the audience and be like, all right, first person to produce a Bic lighter gets $100. First person to give me a, you know, Sacagawea gold dollar, whatever. Those sort of things. Those have actually been around since the beginning. That's not new to Wayne Brady, those quickie deals. Those have kind of always existed, and so that sort of keeps alive that idea, the original idea of bring in something. So I suppose if that's the case, if you're ever planning on going to be on the show, stuff your pockets and purses with a bunch of crap before you go, and, you know.
I don't remember the show very much from my childhood, but I do remember Monty Hall going around and asking people for strange crap, like, who has a 1939 penny?
Right.
And I'd be like, who the hell would have a 1930? And somebody would have a 1939 penny. And I'm like,
yeah, I wonder how often those are staged, where once they pick their traders and get that area filled, maybe the producers will hand out certain items to people. Like, I'm sure it's still random and fair and all that, but like, maybe that 1939 penny was something they knew somebody was going to have. They gave it to somebody.
Right, right.
I don't know. Yeah, I didn't actually look that much into it. But yeah, I have a feeling that during the Wayne Brady one, it's a little more real, because he's asking for much more generic things. It does feel a little oddly specific in the Monty Hall episodes.
Right, right.
All this dealing and wheeling that the host is doing in the audience, this is all leading up to the big deal. So what happens here is the three highest winners of cash and prizes, all added up together, will be selected to given the chance to exchange what they have for what could be behind one of three curtains. You just give up all your prize winnings and say, I want this curtain. So in this situation, you're not really gonna get zonked. There is a low prize curtain, and it is intended to be lower than whatever you previously won. So in theory, even if you were number three on this list, and you gave up your, you know, lowest of the three winnings, and you got the low quote unquote curtain, you're still going to lose out on money. But it may not be a straight up zonk. It's going to be, you know, a parting gift, basically.
Okay.
There's then the medium curtain, which is, you know, a significant win. I've seen it be a couple $1,000s, and then a big prize package in the top tier curtain, which usually includes a car, vacations, cruises, that sort of thing. One, I saw the people got two trips in one. It was like a trip to somewhere and then a cruise from there to somewhere else. And it was like, you know, significant prizes, especially for back in those days when, I don't know, I feel like the world was a bigger place back then. And I guess the idea then is not that the low prize, I was assuming that because they refer to it as a low prize, not a zonk.
Right.
You can get zonked on that technically, but then since you trade in the zonk for money, you're still getting something. So it's not like you're walking out of there empty handed.
Correct. Correct.
Cool. So yeah, at one point there was also a super deal. I didn't look too much into this. It felt very tacked on. It's literally just whoever wins the big deal gets to do it again. You can wager your stuff on another curtain if you want to. And it's like, okay, cool. I guess maybe you ran out of time, so you were like, let's do it again. It seems a little bogus. So
I don't know.
I mean, who cares?
Like, to me, that there's really no gameplay here.
I mean, there really isn't. It's all chance, or like, you know, how much you're willing to risk and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, I'm the kind of person that, you know, if I'm on there and they give me $1,000, like, yeah, $1,000 is great, but you're on Let's Make a Deal. Let's make a deal, right? And I'll, if I get zonked, bummer. But I would absolutely just deal away everything I had on that show just to keep playing. But yeah, it's, yep. There's no strategy. There's no preparing. It's literally just flip a coin almost.
Well, technically there is strategy, and
well, there is,
and we'll have to talk more about that because, we should take a break and come back and get into history. And then we should talk about the Monty Hall problem.
The Monty Hall problem. This is outside of even before we started doing this. This is one of my favorite, like, paradoxical things. I love it.
Cool. Well, we'll talk all about that coming up next. You've been listening to America's favorite game show podcast, Tell Them What They've Won. Welcome back. It's America's favorite game show podcast, Tell Them What They've Won. This is episode number 23, segment number 3. Our featured show this week is
Let's Make a Deal. And diving into the history, the thing is, this show is Monty Hall's show, basically through and through. He is the conceiver, the creator, the whole thing. He did it all. So much so that they even say that the pitch of the show was him pitching himself as much as the show. Along with it. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, that pitch can be seen. It's on YouTube. The very first episode is on there. We'll put the link on the website. But the very first episode, and at the head of it is the pitch of him. It's just him sitting in an empty audience, and the camera slowly pans in, and he describes what he wants the show to be. And apparently it worked, obviously. NBC picks it up, and on December 30th, 1963, we see the first episode air with Monty Hall as the host, of course, and the Carol Merrill as the model that we mentioned earlier in the news, who has the longest running tenure as model on the show.
Right.
Yep. And, I tell you, Monty Hall really... I guess it's probably because it's his show, but he's just such a perfect host for this in the sense that he very, deadpan interacts with the contestants, and not like in a boring way. He's obviously having fun. Right. But I mean more that he doesn't lead them one way or the other. He doesn't give any sort of clues as to what prize is where. He plays it very, very even tone the whole time, which adds a psychological twist to it, kind of.
Well, yeah, and we'll talk more about that when we get to the Monty Hall problem. Uh-huh. But I wonder, he had to know at least some of the time where the prize was, or at least where the zonk was.
My theory is that he knew what they were, I guess, so that he could be prepared to talk about them. But I'm not sure he knew where they were. The only reason why I say that is because I feel like, and I mean, obviously he is a good host, but it feels very, very difficult to me to be able to know that, like, door number two is the big prize and have someone swap out door number two for, you know, a fistful of mud or whatever, and play that deadpan would be very difficult. You know, you'd want to be like, oh God, do you want, you know, there'd be some reaction, I feel.
Maybe. I mean, honestly, if you really want it to work, though, you've got to play that card. So maybe to just make it easier on himself, he didn't know, you know?
Yeah. I mean, who knows? I mean, I'm sure someone, someone knows.
I'm sure someone does know.
Yeah.
Christian Carrion probably knows.
I'm sure he does. But yeah, and there also have been a slew of other models after Carol Merrill, of course, throughout the years, varying fame. But I think we mentioned in the news the Coors Light twins. I don't know if we actually put that one in there or not, but they were on there for a while. But yeah, Carol Merrill really is the name of the model for, I'd say, most of the show, along with Monty Hall, of course. They started on NBC, but in 1968 moved over to ABC. During that run is also when the syndicated version started, which was in 1971. Those both were obviously very, very successful. People love watching Monty Hall make deals. They ran for several years. The daytime edition ended in 76, and the syndicated version ran for a year longer, which I find interesting. I don't know why, but I feel like there's some sort of, if the other version could keep going, why not keep the daytime version going? I don't know.
We are not definitely television producers, I can tell you that.
No, I mean, every time they make these decisions, I don't understand it. Although, in most cases, it's time slot changes, and that ends up drilling the show into the ground. So maybe we should be television producers. One thing that I thought was really cool was the final season of the initial run was hosted in the ballroom of the Las Vegas Hilton. So like it's live in that ballroom in the Hilton, and it's this huge, super fancy affair, and they're all sitting, it's like done like cabaret style, and they're all sitting at cocktail tables, and it's so cool to watch. It just feels very like, I don't know, pompous and hoity-toity for such a ridiculous show.
You know, are they all still dressed up like bananas and things?
You know, I don't remember. I didn't really look. I just sort of like panned through the episode.
Right.
I don't think so.
I'm gonna have to go check it out.
We gotta go double check that. But anyways, there's episodes of it on YouTube, and it's pretty cool to watch, and it's such a huge audience too, because obviously at that point the show was just hugely popular,
gigantic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because you know there's been a bunch of shows that have filmed in Vegas, and we were almost getting to the one that I was involved with, so it'll be interesting.
Oh boy. So yeah, that. Like I said, 76, 77, those were the ends of the original run. And I think it's a lot like with You Bet Your Life, where people wanted a new version of it, but they couldn't do it right. They couldn't find the right person. Monty Hall was such the perfect fit for this game. 1980, there was a version in Canada that got syndicated in US. It lasted one season. In 84, there was a version called All New Let's Make a Deal. Ran for 2 years, which I guess is not bad. And actually, those were hosted by Monty Hall. But something about them just didn't capture that original flair, I guess. And then starting in 1990, that's when we really start to see the non-Monty Hall productions. This version that started in 1990, it was produced by Dick Clark and hosted by Bob Hilton, who, as I recall, is known for being like an announcer on shows, but he had not been at the helm very much before this one that I could find. But yeah, also, you know, did not last. In 2003, they made an attempt at a primetime version. It did not do well. They made 5 episodes, aired 3. So tough luck there. The cool thing, or the thing of note about that version, it was hosted by Billy Bush, which if you recognize that last name of two of our former presidents, he is of that same family.
Really?
Yeah. He was a news reporter, primarily. But yeah, he is part of the Bush family, and he hosted, Let's Make a Deal for 5 episodes, only 3 of
them. Well, for 3 actually aired episodes.
And then there was also a one-off episode in 2006. It was part of like a lineup of special edition shows, and that was hosted by Ricky Lake. But you know, it was not an attempt to revive the show. It was just like a little, like I said,
like a one-off.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep. But like I said, even the ones that were hosted by Monty Hall, none of them recaptured that right vibe. I don't think any of those other hosts. I really want to find a Billy Bush episode, but I can't imagine any of those other hosts capturing the same magic that Monty Hall had. But then in 2009, luckily for some, unluckily for others, Guiding Light was canceled, and that opened the door for the revival on CBS. October 5th, 2009, Wayne Brady as the host, Tiffany Coyne as the model, and it is back and in full swing since 2009, by the way. So
go ahead.
Yeah, it like you said, it makes it the longest running non-contiguous game show. But also I think it's coming up on surpassing the original. It's got to be, right? I didn't do the math, and Tiffany Coyne has got to be approaching Carol Merrill as longest tenured model, right?
Oh yeah, I would say so. I mean, it went 63.
It's 63 to 70. Wait, hang on. Merrill left. When did Merrill leave? 77, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's 14 years. They're at 11 right now, so okay. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, next 3 years. But boy, I tell you, if her physique is anything to show for it, she'll be well to go in 3 to 4 years, no problem.
Yeah, she's definitely quite fit and works out quite a bit.
Indeed, indeed.
She can kick my butt, no problem.
Yep.
No problem.
But yeah, I mean, like I said, this version of the show is very, very popular. It's not too bad. I used to work at our local CBS affiliate here in Atlanta, and I actually ended up just by chance watching this every day, like we, you know, in our little hideaway room where they hide the goblin designers. we would just have the television on the channel, and it would be on mute most of the time, but you could unmute it if you wanted to.
So were you guys goblins, or were you designing goblins?
No. We were the goblins of that station.
Okay.
Kind of tucked away in the back room, no windows. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It was a weird job. Anyways, so I watched it like basically every day. I don't have any problems with him. I'm not a huge fan of him. He's fine. As a host, he's fine. He's better than serviceable, I guess. But it just doesn't do anything for me. And I was expecting to have that same feeling when I went back and watched the Monty Hall ones, and I didn't. I was so into them. I don't know why, but they were so much fun to watch. And he doesn't do it the same way Monty Hall does, and I can't explain why.
Yeah, he's got his own style for sure, which I love that. I love that he's not trying to be Monty Hall. He has his own style. And the co-host guy, John, that he works with, is great. They do a little back and forth banter thing that's fun.
They have a phenomenal rapport, by the way. The two of them work together so well.
And I really hope, and I don't know, but I really hope that they're friends in real life.
Uh-huh.
Because if they're not, it's just sad.
I
agree
100%.
But I will tell you this, I don't like him as a host. I'm just not a big fan, and that's fine. The show isn't for me. It's for other people. It's wonderful. I think the other reason I'm not really crazy about it is because when I was working in Las Vegas, I was working at the Tropicana, and the first season of Let's Make a Deal, maybe even the first two seasons, were filmed at the Tropicana. And we were working in the Players Club. I was in charge of the Players Club there. And it was our job to, as one of the perks that the Tropicana got for hosting the show, everybody got automatically registered for the Players Club. It was like part of your registration to get in to the show. You had to register for the Players Club at Trop. And we gave them all $5 or $10 of free play, basically to get them to hopefully stay and spend a little money. And
sure.
Then we have all that marketing information as well. So we pushed through hundreds of people a day. I mean, hundreds of people. And because, you know, they film, you know, 3, 4, 5 episodes, whatever it is a day that they do.
Sure.
And, you know, you've got a group going through every single time. So, you know, you would. The funny thing is, there are people that are game show hoes, if you want to call them that. I don't think that's really the right word for it. I'm going to say they're game show fanatics. Let's say that, and that they go to tapings all the time, and we would notice the same people coming back over and over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Uh-huh.
And funny enough, most of the people that came to see Let's Make a Deal were from California. And I was like, why aren't they filming this in California? Like, I mean, you know, nobody when they're in Vegas is like, I'm going to get up early in the morning and go see Let's Make a Deal.
That's
like
a very good point.
They're staying up late and drinking, and nobody's coming to see to see the taping of the show.
Well, I mean, obviously not nobody, because it worked out for them in several versions. But I definitely take your point. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it does not.
So needless to say, it was a giant pain in our butt. Everybody on the production crew was pretty nice to us. The producers and the PAs that would come by and see us, they were pretty nice to us. But it was still a large pain in my rump.
You know, and it's funny now that you tell this story, the previous thing I mentioned about it being cool that it was in the ballroom of the Las Vegas Hilton seems significantly less cool now, because it's at like 8 o'clock in the morning and who gives a crap? Nobody's there anyways. And
yeah.
it makes it seem a lot more, because all in those episodes, all the opening shots, of course, are Vegas Strip at night when it's all hustle and bustle. But that's not when it's actually going on. Yeah. I don't know. I worked in television long enough that I should not be disillusioned by these things anymore, but it still happens every time.
You know, it's so funny. Like, you get totally disillusioned and I get reillusioned.
It's like, I just want it to be real so bad.
I don't know. I guess I think it's a lot more fake than it truly is. So when something comes up, I'm like, wow, that's amazing. I thought that was all fake and it's actually real. But needless to say, we saw people in so many different outfits and craziness that came through the trop for that year that we filmed it. And of course, it wasn't a full year that they filmed. They filmed for 8 weeks or whatever they
right.
do, and
yeah.
they go about their business. And then they eventually moved it out to LA after the first or second season, which was fine with me. I actually moved out of there and moved to Cosmo. But that being said, I'm just not a huge fan of the new one. There really is no gameplay.
I mean, right?
There's a little bit, you know, a little fun stuff here and there. Like, oh, let's toss yeah. these ping pong balls in a car. You know, I mean.
Right. Well, and so that's the thing is I feel like the newer version has gotten a lot more like mini game focus as opposed to just like wagering.
Right.
Which I think is a good thing for sure, because it makes it more interesting. But also, again, you can't. Monty Hall was the one that made the wagering as thrilling as it was. And I don't think if you can recreate that you know, you should maybe take a different direction with it, which I think they've done. And it's fine. Again, I don't have any issues with it. It's just not sure. for me.
So let's talk about Monty Hall for a second. Let's take this conversation in a different direction. And let's talk about the Monty Hall problem.
Yes. So I was looking forward to this for a very long time. This is one of my favorite, like, paradox discussion things. Okay, so... Let's say you're on Let's Make a Deal, right?
And okay. I'm the contestant.
You're the contestant. I'm Monty Hall. So I say, hey, Tom, welcome here. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good to see you, Mike.
You have, what do you have to trade for me?
I have this coffee cup that used to be my mom's that she gave me.
All right. This coffee cup, it's got a beautiful sunflower on it. I'll tell you what, for this coffee cup, you can choose any one of these three doors. One of the doors has the best pizza you've ever eaten in your entire life.
Oh.
And the other two doors have a pile of hot, stinky garbage.
Oh, okay.
So,
well, I'm gonna take door number one.
Okay, you want door number one. Okay, so that means you think that door number one has the tasty, delicious pizza. And
correct.
Two and three both contain trash, right?
Stinky garbage. That's
stinky
correct.
Garbage. So I'm going to reveal door number three.
Oh, and, okay.
And look at that. Behind door number three, stinky garbage. You're still
yes.
in the game. Still in
yes.
the game, Tom. So now,
yes.
here's the deal. You can okay. keep your door number one that you've chosen. That was your door. It's yours if you want it. But before we continue, before we see what is behind your door, would you like to switch to door number two, or would you like to stay with the door that you have taken?
Okay, so this is the issue
is the
do
problem.
I have yes, do I have better odds of keeping it or switching it at this point?
Correct.
So the general knowledge part of me says this. I had a 1 in 3 chance to begin with, a 33% chance of getting it right. And once you've taken away one of those, I now have a 50-50 chance of getting it right. But the truth is, that's not the truth. The truth is I still have technically a 33% chance of getting it right.
Correct.
But you've already revealed one of them. And no matter which one I picked, you were going to pick one of the ones that you knew didn't have the pizza behind it.
Absolutely. I'm not going to reveal a pizza to show that you've lost.
Correct.
I'm going to reveal garbage to show that the game is still continuing.
So, okay. So this is the issue. The host doesn't sway you at all, correct?
Well, so that's where the twist comes in, and we can address that later. I want to talk about just the issue itself. So,
if you tell me everything's constant right now, okay, and these are the reasons why I'm asking this. So it's constant that the host is always going to show me a zonk as opposed to my pizza.
That is a constant, yes.
Okay.
But I'm saying is for the purposes of your decision, pretend this is a just monitor in front of you with three doors and text instructions. There's no voice, there's no sound feedback.
Okay.
You just touch the
Good.
Door you want and
right.
so now and it has presented you with the choice of
I feel like I want to switch because I think that I have a better shot if I switch.
So, yes, that is the correct answer.
Is that the correct answer?
It is indeed. Yes.
Okay.
You should switch.
But even though it, I mean, if you look at just the percentage parts of it, it doesn't matter. I could stay or should I go either way, but I know that percentages are not right. You know what I'm
saying?
Right.
And so that's the thing is I think that typically the gut response tends to be the way you mentioned it is either, you've now eliminated a option. So basically it's a 50-50 shot between those two doors, right?
Right.
And when you initially picked, it's a third. So you could theoretically say that second one is still a third. You just happen to know, you know, it's still the same odds. Knowledge right. doesn't change the odds or something like
right,
that.
Right, right, right.
But the point is that the switching doors doubles your likelihood of getting the correct
Jesus.
Answer. And
God, I didn't think it would double it, but okay,
yeah,
that's great.
It basically changes it from a third to 50-50 because the first door, and it's very hard to explain. We're going to put a video up on the website so people can watch it, and it explains it.
Okay.
It actually breaks down.
Okay.
The way it breaks down in the sort of, explain it like I'm eight way, is that there are nine possible outcomes.
Right.
Only three of them is stay and win. The other six are switch and win.
Switch and win.
Right. So you're not guaranteeing anything. You're just changing it from a third to 50-50 that you're going to get it right. Because the first guess you made is a third. And then the second guess you are making is 50-50. The odds of the first one did not change. The odds of the second one did. So basically your rationale was... it got you to the right answer, but sort of in the wrong
backwards.
Way.
Yeah, the wrong way. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, to me, I guess I just feel like I'm supposed to switch. Like if the host is always going to show me where one of the zonks are, then it really doesn't matter which box I pick up front, which door I pick.
That
I'm
is
just gonna go door number two.
Yep.
Because he's going to show me a zonk either way. Then I have to make the gut decision. Once he eliminates that one, where I'm going to go with those other two.
Right. And so that's why they've actually talked to Monty Hall himself about this. And that's kind of the point that he brings up is that the intervention of the host inherently like ruins the theory that we're even talking about, that it's any sort of paradox or changes the percentage, because the percentages are being thrown out because there's an outside factor, a sort of, you know, chaos factor, if you will.
Yeah.
Affecting the way people are thinking about it. So like you say, you know that they are going to show you a garbage. It's not going to show you a random door because then it could theoretically show you yours and you would immediately win or lose.
So that goes to prove that Monty does indeed have to know where the prize is, at least on the big deal at the end.
Well, so I think you're right, except that I have not seen this specific scenario on the show. I think, and I, from what I read about this, this is a thing. It existed before and was called something else. And I think they renamed it to the Monty Hall problem.
Hall problem, yeah.
Because
it
so closely resembled a scenario that could theoretically arise on the show. Now,
right.
it may have happened on the show. I don't know. I'm not saying definitively one way or the other. I'm just saying I watched a whole bunch of this leading up to it. I didn't find anything where this exact situation happens.
Interesting.
But yeah, so it's a fascinating thing to think about. It's called a veridical paradox,
okay.
which basically means that it's something that you can prove to be true, but does not fit like rational truth, basically.
Rational thought. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's just a super interesting thing.
Well, I got to tell you that rational truth kind of fits how I feel about this episode, because I do like it and I don't like it enough to give it a good rating.
I feel exactly the same way.
So I'm going to come out and say, what are we going to rate it on? Doors?
Yeah, doors. I like that. Even though I don't think there's ever been five doors. That's wild.
Yeah, wow. That would be wild. But just imagine how adding one more door could really make a difference.
Oh, man, those odds change big time. I don't even want to do that math.
Anyway, yeah, you guys and your math. I don't know what's
going on.
Well,
and the thing
on.
Is, I hate math, but I love, like, theoretical math.
Yeah, exactly right. I'm going to give it three doors, and because I know that the 2.5 doors is technically half. It's not a 2.5 show. It's definitely a little bit more than that. And because of the legacy of it, I've got to go with 3. I really want to go 2.75, but I'm going to go with 3 because of the legacy of it.
Yeah, we are dead on with rating and rationale this time. I am also going with a 3. It felt better than a 2.5 or a 2.75 just because of the legacy. And like, go watch the old episodes with Monty Hall, and he's so good at building that suspense. And like, the when he throws the commercial, like, that's a thing they do all the time now on like Millionaire Weakest Link and things like that. But the way he would do it, you just wouldn't expect it, because he does not change his demeanor at all. He doesn't hint at it. He's just so good at being deadpan. I love him so much as the host of this show. But it's not a game. There's nothing there. It's just a bunch of like, flip a coin, basically, you know?
But I also feel like he's such a national treasure that if we rate lower than a 3, then we're rating him lower than a 3.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? This is right. Such his show.
Well, and it's such a part of like Americana, you know, the fact that they renamed a, you know, thought, what do they call those, thought experiment after him, is, you know, a statement in and of itself. I remember in college, while I was there, they built the new building for our computer arts track or whatever. And it was called Montgomery Hall, which of course means nobody called it anything but Monty Hall for the rest of the time that I was in college. Oh, where's Adam? Oh, he had to sleep at Monty Hall last night. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's, everybody knows it. Everybody knows him. It's an indelible part of American history.
All right. Well, that's all the time we've got for today.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Christian. Thank you, folks at Buzzer Blog. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Mom and Dad. I don't know. That's what they do, right? I don't think my parents listen, but if you do, thanks.
I'm kind of upset that your parents don't listen, to be honest with you.
I mean, I honestly don't know. I've never asked them.
All right. Tune in again next time. We'll bring you the latest and greatest in the world of game shows, as well as a brand new featured game show, too.
And remember, you can catch us online, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, of course, tellthemwhattheyvewon.com.
Please subscribe, share, like, and drop a review if you like what you heard.
And if you don't like it, I hope you get a zonk.
See you next week, Mike.
Bye, Tom.
You've been listening to America's favorite game show podcast, Tell Them What They've Won, a JTAC audio production, copyright 2020. No part of this podcast may be reproduced by anyone without the express written consent of the creators. For more information or to contact us, please go to tellthemwhattheyvewon.com. All right, Mike, and what did you learn this week?
I learned the term vertical paradox.
I still don't know what it means, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, go look up the Wikipedia. It'll explain.
Yeah, there you go. I learned that, God rest his soul, Mr. Alex Trebek and Mr. Monty Hall as well are national treasures. And it is possible that the same way I feel about Monty Hall being the national treasure of this game show, definitely Alex Trebek is the national treasure of Jeopardy. And I'm just going to miss them both.
You couldn't have said it better myself. Yeah, nobody will be able to replace Trebek.
Copyright 2020, a JTAC audio production.